Welcome to our session today with Stephen Denyer. Stephen is a senior lawyer at Allen & Overy. He's been in practice since 1978, so he has a lot of experience. He is currently the head of global markets at A&O in London. That's a senior post which involves overseeing the firm's approach to markets where the firm doesn't have a presence. And it also involves coordinating ties with relationship firms. He represents A&O with regulatory and professional bodies, including the International Bar Association. He was the regional managing partner for Europe for about 10 years. He has worked in a number of jurisdictions abroad, including his role has included establishing offices from scratch in various jurisdictions. He was most recently based in Frankfurt and before that at some stage in Italy and in Poland. In October, the Law Society appointed Stephen as its new city and international head, a role that he'll start in May. And he will be responsible for strengthening the Law Society's ties with larger firms in relation to their domestic and international activities. It'll be interesting to learn more about what that role will entail. So I'll hand over to Stephen.
Well, it's really great to be here. Thanks for coming along. I'm going to be leaving plenty of time at the end for questions, so please do think of some questions that you'd like to ask me. I'm joined here today by two colleagues, Belinda, raise your hand, Belinda, and Sally. So they're here to answer all the difficult questions. I'll do the easy ones. So what I'm going to be talking to you about, as you'll already have heard from the introduction, is this process of globalisation of the market for legal services, which has actually taken place during my working life, and which I've been personally strongly involved with, not only on behalf of Allen & Overy, but also on behalf of the International Bar Association and the American Bar Association, and I hold senior officer positions in both of those two organisations. So, you know, I'm going to check if I can actually move the slides on. There we are. I was just pressing the wrong button. There we go. Just a very brief introduction to A&O. We're a very large law firm, one of the largest law firms in the world. More than 500 partners like me owning the business, but one global integrated lockstep firm. Origined in the UK, but the British today are in a minority in A&O. Less than 40% of the firm is British, whether you're looking at the partners or where we do business, etc. And that percentage drops every year, not because the British component in the firm is shrinking in absolute terms, but because the other parts of the firm are growing faster, and that's one of the illustrations of the process of globalisation I'm going to be talking about. We're a very large business. If we were a listed company in the UK, which of course we're not, we would be comfortably within the FTSE 100 top British businesses. So a turnover of more than £1 billion, and we're very widely spread across the world. 43 offices, 10 of which actually I've been personally involved in opening, currently in 30 countries. This is the world according to A&O. The dark areas like Russia and China and the USA, those are places where A&O does business in its own right, so through our own offices in those countries. But perhaps equally interesting is the blue countries. So the blue countries are all the places in the world where we do such a lot of business that we have established means of working there through close relationships with leading local firms without actually having a physical presence. Sometimes we don't have a physical presence because we choose not to have one, because we choose to work with leading local firms. Sometimes we don't have a physical presence because we're not allowed to have one. So India, for example, is a classic example of a jurisdiction we're not allowed to establish in. But basically what this tells you is that a firm like mine, and the same would apply to Clifford Chance or Linklaters or Freshfields or White and Case or Scaddens, we literally do business all over the world on a continuous basis. So any of our offices you go into, you find people particularly involved in cross-border transactions. And this is a wider illustration of the way in which the overall global market for legal services is developing. So what do people in firms like mine do? Well, this is our practice area breakdown. The largest practice areas being corporate banking, international capital markets, and litigation and disputes. Were we a US origined firm, the litigation and disputes bit would be significantly higher, because on average firms originated in the US do a higher proportion of that kind of work, simply because there's a bigger market for disputes in the US than anywhere else in the world, and the US is still the largest single market for legal services in the globe. But people doing corporate work, banking work, international capital work, markets work, that is almost inevitably going to be multi-jurisdictional. The vast bulk of the work we do anywhere in the world involves multiple jurisdictions, often a very large number of jurisdictions in a single transaction. And of course, that work tends to come to firms like mine because we've got this capacity, both in terms of the number of jurisdictions we work in regularly and also in terms of our knowledge of market practice in relation to all of those kinds of transactions. Now, the main thing I want to talk to you about today is some of the big trends that we're seeing in the world, because I think at whatever stage in your life you're at, whether you've worked before, as I know many of you have, or whether you're going to be entering the workforce for the first time sometime after finishing here, you're going to be operating in a world which is being shaped by some of these large trends. And these trends that I have personally observed in my career, and they're also trends that the firm has been tracking, because we think these will be the major things that influence how a business like ours needs to operate in the decades to come. However, I would say these trends are not only relevant for you if you're going to be a business lawyer with a major law firm like mine. They will shape legal practice in all fields. So people doing human rights work, or people doing work in areas such as immigration or family law, for example, I would argue are going to be equally influenced by the trends. So what are they? Well, firstly, we're living in a world where the total global economy is growing to an extent never before seen in the history of the world. The total GDP of the world increases monumentally year on year, and has done for the last few decades. That's partly fueled simply by population growth, but to a significant extent it is fueled by a bigger and bigger part of the world being part of the global economy. So whereas when I was young, there were significant parts of the planet which were outside the global economy to a large extent, now there are hardly any pockets that are outside of that. You might think of North Korea as one example, to an extent possibly Cuba. Even those countries people would expect to come in within the next decade or so, particularly as a result of regime change or death. But if you think of all the countries that used to be on the sidelines, be it countries in Africa or Asia, or even Latin America or Central America to a certain extent, or some of the old Soviet and other communist bloc countries, all of those in my working lifetime have entered the world economy and are causing it to grow exponentially, and of course thereby fueling demand for all sorts of things that feed into the legal sector. So the percentage of the world economy represented by the service sector, and specifically represented by legal services, that percentage is also growing as economic growth forces the development of those kind of services. We're also in a world where, by and large, there is more human movement than there ever has been before in history. Now, of course, we're standing here in a jurisdiction where there is unlimited movement for the citizens of the European Union. There is free movement across the EU, with 30-plus countries participating in that. But even though you might say, well, that's at one extreme end of the spectrum, if you look at the amount of movement of people into and out of more or less every country in the planet, that is increasing. Sometimes it's economic migration, sometimes it's migration for personal reasons, intercultural marriages and relationships, of course, are at a much higher level than they ever have been before. Sometimes it's people in employment whose employers are moving them around. And if you look at a large part of the A&O workforce, they or their partners or spouses can easily be in that environment where it's the employment dimension that is causing the movement. That, of course, is leading to more multicultural societies. More or less everywhere you go, like you go to Africa now, large Chinese populations pretty much in every country. Come here, of course, and you find large populations, for example, from the countries of Central and Eastern Europe. Go to the US, and we know that that Spanish and Portuguese is becoming more dominant as languages as a result of migration up from the Latin and Central American region. The world population on average is better educated than it ever has been before. More people going through higher levels of education. And that's one of the things that has a profound effect on how lawyers operate and how lawyers practice and what people want of lawyers. The lawyer's role now is less and less about opining on the law and delivering tablets of stone that a grateful client can take away and cherish for life in a way that it was when I was young. Because the law is Googleable like everything else. You know, people can find out for themselves about the law and legal requirements. So they less and less want the lawyer to be telling them those things, the practitioner. They increasingly want them to be telling them things that they can't Google, things about judgment and what should they actually do. So it has a profound impact on how we operate as practicing lawyers. The economy is now truly globalised, so any major Allen & Overy client will be doing business in more countries than A&O is in, for example. So A&O currently, as I said, is in 30 countries. Just about any major client of ours you can think of, be it a manufacturing company, a service provider, a financial institution, a natural resource company, almost inevitably it's going to be doing business in more than 100 countries. So more than three times the number of countries that we operate in. There are very nearly 200 countries in the world currently, divided into more than 320 jurisdictions. That obviously takes account of those countries that have more than one jurisdiction within them, like the United States of America, or indeed the United Kingdom, where Scotland and Northern Ireland are separate jurisdictions. So the question for the practicing lawyer is, how can you imagine where the next client to approach you is going to be doing business? How can you set your priorities? Well, this is a question that we in my firm have been grappling with for quite a few years. So we thought the best thing to do, if you're a wise service provider, you're not sure of the answer to something, best thing to do is ask your clients. So we asked 1,000 of our clients which are the five most important jurisdictions. We thought this would be a very good way of deciding where we put our resources. So we asked them all, name five countries, the most important, going to be the most important countries for you doing business the next 10 years. Unfortunately for us, between them, they named every country on the planet. So there was no country that was not going to be important to one of our important clients. Why is that? It's because so much of economic activity is now segmented. It's segmented, on the one hand, according to products and services. So are they a mining company, a pharma company, a manufacturing company, a service providing business? But it's also segmented according to where they feel they've got their natural strengths. Do they feel they're particularly strong in this or that geography? So there is absolutely no way of predicting which is going to be the next important country you need to be able to operate effectively in to maintain your competitive advantage. And that means you've got to be ready for it being any country. And since you can't be in every country, you have to have alternative means of tackling work in the places where you are not going to be physically present. One constraint in the old days that used to stop business taking place anywhere in the world were the restrictions that used to exist in relation to the movement of capital. So many countries, including this one, for example, used to have exchange control provisions that stopped money moving freely from one country to another. Those largely have disappeared. So capital in the shape of cash, but also in the shape of all sorts of other financial instruments, now flows around the world freely like water. So it will end up in the places where it can achieve the best return. So the lawyer again has to be equipped to flow behind it. Go to any Allen & Overy or Clifford Chance office in the world and you will find some magnificent meeting rooms with every possible facility you might need for conducting a negotiation and concluding a contract. By and large, I suspect, those meeting rooms are being used less and less on average. And the reason is because more and more of our business doesn't actually involve physical meetings with people or even a physical get-together to conclude a contract or something of that kind. In many senses, more and more of our business is done in cyberspace. It's done by people who could be anywhere on the planet, sitting at their laptop or sitting at their terminal and interacting with others, be that through email or interactive programs that allow them to share the drafting of documents or conference facilities, be it video or phone, that allow potentially hundreds of people to take part in the same discussion, the same interaction. So that does throw up profound questions about how you determine where and how and whether the legal obligations have been entered into. The volume and would-be comprehensive ambit of regulatory law in the world is increasing exponentially. Pretty much every government now thinks that the best way to respond to the latest scandal, the latest crisis, the latest thing that has gone wrong in their country is to regulate it. So whether you look at regulation in relation to criminal activities or the assistance of crime, or in relation to business activities, undesirable practices like cartels and so on, or financial regulation, consumer protection, you name it, governments want to regulate it to a much higher extent than they ever have done before. And those regulations increasingly are incompatible with each other, different governments adopting different regulatory regimes, real headache if you're operating in multiple jurisdictions. And also they're increasingly backed up by criminal sanctions, by real teeth, by provisions that might actually involve people being locked up, potentially. And so this is right at the top of the mind now of the chairman, the chief executive, the board of every major business that we act for. What are all these regulatory rules? How do we manage our risk in relation to them? And that is what they are increasingly turning to their in-house legal departments. In-house legal departments are becoming bigger and stronger and more influential, but also to their external lawyers. And increasingly, they're wanting their external lawyers, in conjunction with their in-house legal departments, to make judgment calls about whether and how these regulations can be complied with, but nevertheless, the businesses can carry on to operate profitably. My colleague Philip Wood is very fond of measuring world law, something he's been doing for a long time. And on the Philip Wood World Law Index, which measures the amount of new law enacted, the amount of new law in the world keeps going up. Every year there's more new law than there was in the previous year, be that new statutes, new binding cases, or whatever. And that's partly due to the fact that governments actually have the capacity to enact a lot of new law. They've got the bureaucracies and the instruments of state that allow them to enact new law. But also, it's also going hand in hand with a fragmentation, as Philip has described it, of law. So less and less of the new law that is coming in is following the traditional patterns of the common law of England or New York, or the Napoleonic system of France, or the Romano-Germanic traditions of the Roman Empire and Prussia, Germany, etc., where you could predict to an extent what the outcomes were going to be. Law and the new law is less predictable than the old law, because it's going to be much more influenced by short-term political, economic, and other considerations. So guessing what the law is a less and less easy task. So what are the consequences for how lawyers work? Well, it means as a practitioner, we have to be comparative lawyers. By and large, the sort of clients that my firm act for will not pay us for advising them on the laws of a single jurisdiction. What they want from us and what we deliver to them is a comparative overview of the relevant legal provisions of multiple jurisdictions, how those differ from each other, and how they can navigate their way through the inconsistencies of those. So a practitioner today is much more required to be a comparative lawyer, to have an overview in their area, be it finance or corporate or disputes or whatever, of how the laws in different jurisdictions are going to play out in relation to the same subject. And so obviously you can't do that alone. You can only do that in collaboration with a wide network of people, be they within your own firm or through other networks of relationships that you have. The world and legal regimes is now very much focused on the outcome. So if you look at a lot of the new regulation that comes in, it is focused on what is the acceptable or the unacceptable outcome, and therefore if it's within the scope of what's acceptable, it's permitted, and if it's beyond that scope, it's prohibited, for example. So that is increasingly how our clients are looking at it, and therefore increasingly how the lawyers are looking at it as well. So legal advice today is less and less about saying, if you follow this process and procedure and then that process and procedure and then another one, then you will tick all of these boxes and achieve this particular result. And much more about, is this within the scope of the spirit of the intention of what the law was trying to achieve? And is it actually going to deliver the desired outcome for the client? So the modern lawyer, the modern business lawyer, has to embody three different characteristics. So simultaneously, they need to be a trusted advisor, a project manager, and a risk manager. Now, what will immediately strike you about those characteristics is they all require experience. So one of the fundamental questions for the legal profession at large is how do you enable people to gain that experience when obviously clients typically won't run the risk of somebody just beginning to learn the ability to be a trusted advisor, project manager and risk manager on their bet the company piece of work. So that's a real conundrum which not only law firms but also academic institutions like this one need to focus on. But let's drill into what those three things mean. So the lawyer's trusted advisor. So this is the lawyer putting her or his head on the block. So saying, in my judgment, you should do this, it's okay to do this, or in my judgment, you shouldn't do this, it's not okay to do it. Normally the lawyer is doing that collaboratively together with the general counsel and other senior people within the client institution, frequently obviously with other professional advisors as well. But it's getting away from the old demand of the client of I'd like, when asked what kind of lawyer I'd like, said I'd like a one-handed lawyer. And the reason was that they were fed up with their lawyer saying on the one hand this, on the other hand that, and on the third hand something else. So we're having to get off the fence in practice and say, yes, this is okay, or no, this is not okay. And that means much more judgment, much more thinking about the wider context rather than box ticking. We're running typically massive transactions, billions at stake, huge numbers of jurisdictions, lots of different parties, tight timescales, etc. That is the classic territory of a project manager. And to be a successful project manager, obviously you need to acquire project management skills, which you typically don't learn at law school. So it's about thinking about how major projects, infrastructure projects or other big complicated things like the building of a new large passenger aircraft, how have those been managed and put together, and how have all the components been delivered at the right time in the right place. And then there's this whole area of risk. The risk manager, the person who's looking around beyond the immediate commercial and financial pressure to get the individual deal done, and is either saying this is too risky, we shouldn't do it, or the risk is acceptable, we'll do it. It's not about eliminating risk. Of course, any business would go bust if they eliminated all possible risk. You only make money ultimately by taking some risks, but it's about measuring those risks and managing them. And again, this requires wider knowledge. If you're working, as Belinda does, for example, in project finance, you need a knowledge of how some of those, how the economics of some of those projects work, and how the practicalities of oil extraction or pipeline usage or whatever work are beyond the legal framework that it's operating in. So firms have a big responsibility now to equip their lawyers, especially their younger lawyers, with those kind of skills. And that's why more and more of the soft skill training, for example, done by firms is centered around those kind of skills and ability. And of course, all of this is going on in a world where not just the lawyers, but everybody operating it is expected to be more accessible than ever before. So you're never away from your mobile telephone or your BlackBerry or whatever. And you need to be able to utilize, obviously, all of that ability to communicate effectively to maintain the contact with a very broad and diverse team, as well as with your clients, where things move really fast and change very fast, and you've got to be adaptable to that. And where the value proposition for law firms is proving more and more difficult. So every single Allen Overy client next year will want to spend less on legal services than they did this year, and the year after that will want to spend less than they did next year, and so on and so on and so on. So every one of our clients has a concrete plan to reduce the amount they spend on legal services. On the other hand, every one of them, by and large, wants more legal service delivered. So at the end of the day, they are demanding more for less. They want more from us for less money. We, on the other hand, are running a business, and we would like our business to become more profitable year on year. So how are those two things going to be reconciled? They are, in practice, reconciled by increased efficiency. So every year, we get more efficient, and we have to get more efficient, at delivering our services than we were the year before. That means much more use of technology. It means much better management of our resources. It means much more commercial judgments about what things we're not going to do, as well as what things we are going to do. So in that sense, we're operating in a competitive environment which is forcing us to innovate, because the value pressure and efficiency pressure then forces innovation. And therefore, the successful lawyer is increasingly the innovative lawyer who can do things a different way from the traditional way of doing it. So when you're standing by your laptop and wondering what's going to happen next, as most practitioners frequently are nowadays, you have to bear in mind the next client to pop up in your inbox could be wanting to deal with any jurisdiction in the world, and you better have a plan ready for how you're going to deal with that jurisdiction. It's not enough to say, very interesting, we'll find out a bit about Liberia and come back to you. You've got to have a plan which enables you to respond positively and confidently to that demand, whichever jurisdiction it might relate to. Fortunately, within law firms, you will find an increasingly diverse array of lawyers. So A&O operates in 30 countries, as I said. We've got lawyers qualified in more than 80 countries. So we've got lawyers qualified in many, many jurisdictions where we don't operate, because we need that diversity. It's not necessarily that they're advising on the laws of Cameroon or wherever they might happen to be qualified, but it's because having that diversity within the firm greatly enhances our ability to respond to some of these trends. And of course, more and more of them, currently about 400 or so of them, are multiple qualified. So are qualified in more than one jurisdiction. So most commonly, they might be qualified in their home jurisdiction and then additionally admitted either in New York or in England and Wales. But within the firm, you'd actually find more or less any combination of jurisdictions of qualification you could think of. So the UK, eventually, after a period of ignoring this for about 40 years, has woken up to the fact that make it easier for people to qualify in England as a secondary qualification really helps our globally competitive situation, particularly as against New York, which is our main global competitor for governing law. And so if you look at the regime for qualifying in the UK, it's become much more streamlined. So, for example, the requirement to do a traineeship for lawyers who are already qualified in another jurisdiction, qualifying in England as a secondary jurisdiction, have gone away. And of course, that's then reflected in the success and the diversity of programmes like the one that you're on, which is much broader and greater than it has been in the UK in the past. So the days when if you wanted a really internationally minded lawyer from around the world, you went to the US and looked for them. That is less the case. There's still lots and lots of them to be found in the US, but more, fortunately, to be found here as well. Lawyers move. I've lived and worked in multiple jurisdictions, as you've heard, and that's increasingly common. And the barriers to doing that generally are dropping. There's complete free movement within Europe, assuming you're an EU national and you're qualified in an EU member state. I could practice anywhere in any one of the 36 countries. So when I moved to Germany, for example, I didn't need to re-qualify in Germany. I didn't even need to learn German. I just had to show that I was duly admitted as an English solicitor, that I was a citizen of an EU member state, the UK in my case, and that I was of good standing with my professional body. I hadn't done anything terrible, in other words, and I could go along to a German court and be admitted as a registered foreign lawyer, allowing me to practice there. Had I wished to, having been there for 3 years, I could automatically have taken on the title of a German Rechtsanwalt without learning German or studying German law. I chose not to do that for obvious risk management reasons, but it's a very powerful manifestation of the way in which we're now operating in an open market. Sadly, the people who write the rules governing legal practice have failed to wake up to this. So if you looked at the rules of the New York Bar, or the practice rules here in the UK, or the French rules, or the German rules, they're more or less completely incompatible with each other. So if you look at a really important issue in practice, conflict of interest, if you're potentially acting for parties with different interests in relation to the same or related transaction, the rules on conflict are fundamentally different between New York, the UK, and Germany, ranging from a very widely described nature of conflict in New York, but with generally complete freedom to waive it by agreement, to a very narrowly written definition of conflict in Germany, but with no power to waive it. So if you're a US admitted lawyer who's also admitted in England and you're practicing in Germany, and you've got a transaction with a potential conflict in it, then deciding which of those rules you're going to comply with is actually a major practical problem. General counsel now are amazingly sophisticated and knowledgeable. Many of the very best lawyers in the world have become general counsel of some of the world's great corporations and financial institutions. They're a match to anything you would find in a major international law firm in terms of legal knowledge and expertise and authority. And they're sitting on top of a huge internal law firm. Most of our clients, legal departments, well over 1,000 lawyers in them. So these guys are really sophisticated, not just buyers of legal services, but collaborators with us in the delivery of legal services, because more and more of what we do is collaborative. More and more of our work is being commoditized, standardized, packaged, sold for a fixed price. And that trend is being pushed by the arrival of alternative service providers, now permitted by the law in the UK. So non-lawyers getting into the legal services industry and delivering cheaper, standardized, packaged legal services. Law firms have to respond to that by delivering a more flexible array of services to their clients. And increasingly, our clients are not giving us whole transactions and saying, just go away and do it all for us and come back and tell us when you've done it. Increasingly, they're engaging in something called unbundling, where they take an overall piece of work they want done and they salami slice it, and they give different bits of the job to different people. So they give the rocket science complicated bit to Alan and Overy, for example, and they bring in a lower tier, lower cost firm to do another big bit of the transaction. Maybe they do part of it in-house. Maybe they have an outsourced operator from India doing some of the more standardized, much more routine kinds of the work. Makes perfect business sense, but obviously they're knitting those different pieces of the patchwork quilt back together again at the end is a challenge. So against all of that background, if I was starting out with my career today, what would I attach particular importance to? Well, I'd attach a lot of importance to comparative law, as I've explained. I would think seriously about being qualified in more than one jurisdiction, which I think will become increasingly valuable. Particularly as a student, I would look for opportunities to compete globally, and the moots are one classic example of this. You think of the range of moot competitions there are in the world and the extent to which they become like the Olympic Games of legal skill, if you like. And also now the diversity of teams that are winning. At Moscow State University won the Jessup moot competition 2 years ago, for example, which is not something you would have predicted when I was first visiting Moscow State University 20 years ago or so. Whole range of organisations. I'm a massive fan of the International Bar Association, which now has student membership at a very reasonable price. But similarly, the American Bar, for example, and of course there's all of the organisations specifically focused at young lawyers, like Asia, or of course at students particularly, like ELSA, the European Law Students Association. And although, of course, there are financial implications to this, the range of conferences and other activities that one can participate in. But you have a fantastic opportunity here to start the foundations or develop your network. So much of the time that I spend collaborating with people in other jurisdictions is collaborating with people that I've met in person. It's much easier to collaborate with people you've actually met in person. And so the multinational, multilingual, multicultural nature of programs like this is a real asset that you can build on a lot. And then there's a vast amount of literature. Pretty much every business school in the world now is studying the market for legal services, because we are big business. So whether you go down the road to the Judge Business School here, or you go over to Harvard or anywhere else in the world, then you will find lots of business professors writing about the evolution of legal services market. And then there's a lot of other influential thinkers. Richard Susskind, for example. Some of you may have read some of his books. If not, certainly recommend it. I think he's written five or so far, describing in much more detail than I've had time for in this talk some of the kinds of trends that I've been referring to. So there's quite a few practical tools at your disposal, I would argue. So I promised that I would finish a quarter to, and I've hit that bang on, so I'm rather pleased with that, which means that we've now got about 10 minutes or so for questions before the next activity comes in. So ask me a question.